Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. The other day I was thinking about some crazy friends I had in college. You know, like I thought I was learning, you know, maybe from the professors and the exams and the tests or whatever, but as I get, even as I get older, more I realize I learned from a lot of the people around me. And one fellow in particular of a particular note was Charles Kroningold. And Charles Kroningold was a brilliant, wonderful, creative genius, and he led a lot of our sort of cultural events. We would religiously watch Star Trek reruns, which we refer to as the Old Testament, meaning the original series, as opposed to the New Testament that was just about coming online at that point. And we would sneak into dining halls and steal food in the middle of the night so we could have a nice snacks during our festival of TV watching. And Mr. Kroningold gave me one sort of way of looking at culture that has never left me since then. And our today's guest really, runs with this football. And, you know, it basically had to do with this structure that we're all kind of familiar with of highbrow, middlebrow, and lowbrow. And I think these distinctions developed sometime in the early to middle of the 20th century as a way of kind of organizing, you know, cultural knowledge. And we all kind of know what that means. We might have different definitions of what we put in where, but, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, cheesy slasher B movies are lowbrow, and it's pretty clear that Jean-Paul Sartre is highbrow, right? In the convention, and middlebrow is kind of like the New York Times op-ed, you know, it's middlebrow, straight ahead. NPR is sort of middlebrow, and you can get into finer distinctions: upper middlebrow, lower. You know, you can go crazy with these things, like all classifications, and it can be kind of fun. But really, the genius move is to go, well, what's best? Well, what should you be filling your limited amount of cultural and intellectual time with? Do you just go with the highbrow all the time so you can be a highbrow and just sort of get this sort of area? No, that's tedious. Do you just eat lowbrow all the time? No, it's too much. You get fat, it's bad, it rots your brain, there's no perspective. Middlebrow? Well, you know, sometimes it's good to dip into middlebrow so that you can communicate with, you know, your aunt, and you can kind of like, it's a way to kind of put your finger on the zeitgeist so you can kind of tune in and get the sense of what the dominant discussion is. But really, you should probably be limiting your diet on the middle brow. But the genius move is the high-low brow. Because once you start thinking about the high-low brow, then all the bets are off. Things open up. Possibilities emerge. An obvious example of high-low brow is, to take a classic example, is Shakespeare. Shakespeare was loved by the plebeians of the day. They had a riotous good time. They loved the fart jokes. They loved all the sex. People ate it up, and it was written for these folks. And at the same time, as you know, if you apply your most, you know, genius, literary, critical, poetic, historical mind to the complexities of Shakespeare's characterization and the language, et cetera, you know, you have this enormous industry, you know, of academic scholarship, and beyond that, just people who continually return to Shakespeare because there's just always more, because it feeds your mind as well as your soul. That's a great, you know, example. But even Sartre is kind of a lowbrow in some ways. I mean, his novels are kind of, they're sort of horror novels in a way. I mean, they're really ghastly. And so once you have that high-lowbrow perspective in mind, you can play with things a lot more. Suddenly, lowbrow items actually hold secret keys to deep esoteric secrets and you know, fine points of philosophical engagement with the world, and vice versa. You find in, you know, the highbrow realm of erudite philosophy and, you know, analytic thinking about culture and society, you find within there these sort of gems and nuggets of of juicy bits to tune into to go, yeah, I can get down with that. That's cool, you know. Zizek is probably a good example of a philosopher who really plays to the low, you know, with his references to popular cinema and, you know, also fart jokes and things like that. So, anyway, our guest today, not coincidentally, is the editor of High Lowbrow, which is an excellent website, one of my favorite places online. I think Time Magazine called it one of the 10 best webzines recently. And he's also the publisher of a new imprint, High Low Books, which we'll be talking about in its interest with science fiction. But before that, he was a zine guy back in the day when I was making my way outside of this, outside of the academy. His Hermina books were, or zines were extraordinary. So really happy to have Joshua Glenn on the show. But before we bring him on, let's bring on, of course, Maja Dao. Maja, how you doing?
I'm good, Eric. You know, High Low Brow really is just as above, so below, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, there's a line that the poet Robert Duncan has where he says, what is it? It's like how the sublime is you know, transporting as the profane, because ultimately they're the same kind of thing. I mean, it's like
true. It's really very tantric if you think about it, right? Looking for God in the poop is the idea behind High Lowbrow. And I'm a huge fan of, like, the scandalous genius, right? I mean, like, you gave some really good examples. I also would put, like, Oscar Wilde or Baudelaire or, like, Toulouse-Lautrec or these people whose intelligence is so well developed that they can actually see beauty and God in those, like, kind of mundane profundities. That really is, like, a very special kind of genius, I think.
Yeah, and it's a kind of humor, too. I mean, our engineer, Matt, reminded me that Howard Stern and South Park are both examples.
Totally.
Of this as well. I mean, satire, you often find that that extra edge or that kind of flavor. So it's a wonderful way to think about culture. So with no further ado, let's bring Joshua onto the show. Joshua, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
That's great. So, well, let's see, I'm trying to figure out where to start exactly. I want to definitely get to High Low Books and the Radium Age science fiction stuff, but maybe to talk a little bit more about High Low Brow, the website, and sort of what you're kind of trying to carve out there. I mean, it's so hard to sort of make a space. You know, it's a real challenge to, you know, create an online magazine where you have multiple voices, but it has enough character and specific sensibility that people go back to it because they can kind of identify with a certain vibe, a certain kind of perspective. And obviously we've been talking about the High Low Brow and your whole approach to thinking about culture and philosophy and politics. So maybe talk a little bit about what led you to the site and how you wanted it to come out.
Well, as you remember, back in the 90s, I was publishing Herminot, which is a word that I made up because I had basically dropped out of graduate school where I was studying philosophy and religion, and this word hermeneutics was always popping up, which is a $10 way of saying the search for meaning. And I just wondered why you couldn't talk about the search for meaning in a way that wasn't off-putting to non-academics. So to me, the idea of a hermeneut was sort of a semi-humorous, semi-serious figure who was adventurously searching for meaning outside of the academy in the real world, and I was very much attracted to some of the figures that your lovely and brilliant co-host was just mentioning, like Oscar Wilde and Baudelaire were some of the hermeneuts of the month that we would write about. Simone Weil, Bruce Lee, Nietzsche, all these figures who you know, weren't constrained by this kind of false dichotomy between the highbrow and the lowbrow, between intuition and imagination and spirituality and religion on the one hand, and kind of more analytical, critical, philosophical intelligence on the other hand. And I agree with you that it kind of Shakespeare is sort of an important figure in the history of this, of the sundering of the brows, because, like you say, you know, in the 16th, 17th century, I don't think there really was a split between highbrows and lowbrows. There's something to do with early modernity, the modernizing process. I haven't yet traced it back exactly what happened. Different people have different ideas. Dwight MacDonald thought it had something to do with industrialization and the mills and things. But somewhere in the 19th century or the late 18th century, the brows were split, and you were supposed to choose between the two. Van Wyck Brooks says that Jonathan Edwards and Ben Franklin were the first people who kind of decided they were only going to be highbrow or only going to be lowbrow. And yeah, so somewhere in there, somewhere in early modernity to mid early modernity, they stopped talking to each other, and it's kind of this tragedy of that they, you know, those sensibilities always want to come back together. All of us are both highbrows and lowbrows. There's no such thing as someone who's purely one or the other, except in fiction.
Well, it's so hilarious because what ends up, I think, invariably happening to these people that classify themselves as highbrows, they get caught in these lowbrow scandals because
right,
they keep it,
right,
like, in the shadows.
The people who deny,
right?
Who deny,
yeah,
sexuality and deny the id and so forth, yeah, they're obviously the most insane people of all and the most insanely controlled by their desires.
Yeah, and there's a whole political, you know, angle too, in the sense that, you know, just how much damage has been done to, just to take American culture, by the idea that particularly the things that we might associate with highbrow, Nietzsche is a great example, is someone who just belongs over there, you know, in that academic world,
mm-hmm,
the world,
right,
of Tweedy, you know, pipe smoking, you know, people with graduate students, you know, that's where that stuff belongs. And so if things have been pegged as highbrow in some way, that it makes them less available in a sense, you know.
And there's a strong political aspect to that. I mean, there's been several books in the last 10 years or so about how there really was a kind of political push to get continental philosophy out of the academy and to marginalize it. And to put an analytical philosophy and all these kind of more highbrow things that weren't about morals and values and the way you should live your life, and they weren't as progressive and they weren't as liberal and so forth, or not necessarily liberal, but just not, they were, you know, they were trying to talk about life and how to live it and what the best way to be in the world is, mm-hmm, which often, you know, it could be progressive or it could be conservative, but there was a push to get that out and to make everything more scientific, and everything had to be very logical, ultra-rational, and had to be kind of modeled on the physical sciences as much as possible. So the human sciences became this arid wasteland of statistics and, you know, trying to get to some kind of uncontestable truth, which you just can't do, I think, in the human sciences as in philosophy.
Well, yeah, and this also comes around on the other side, on the humanities side, to writing. And, you know, if you're engaged with writing for a popular audience, as, you know, you have been in your sort of more like on the edge kind of way, or writing really mainstream material, it's like you have to engage the pleasure of the reader in a certain direct,
mm-hmm,
way that, you know, most people who write books for the humanities, or most, you know, intellectuals who are trained on the humanities side of things, you know, or who are still supposedly dealing with issues of meaning and spirituality and intuition and all these kinds of things, is that they don't have to do that anymore. In fact, they are encouraged not to, because the system is set up to not reward a kind of pleasure in the reading.
Yeah.
And therefore, they lose touch with the juice that comes from that lowbrow play, whether it's a love of jokes or puns or popular allusions or rich writing or rich metaphors, and this whole kind of way of engaging, you know, different levels of our minds or our sensibilities in writing. And so it's really a terrible shame. And I know that for me, that like reading Hermannaut back in the day was incredibly inspiring, because it was like, oh great, I'm not alone. There's other people out here, you know, like, oh, you know, there's a way to do this, and it really hardens me to have been able to keep it going.
It's really nice to hear you say that, because one of the things I was very scared of when I was leaving academia and decided not to pursue grad school and trying to become a professor and all those things back in the 90s was I was scared that I would lose community. You know, that there's an amazing thing about school, that you're in this community of learners engaged on the same questions. And especially in the days before the web and all these ways that we now have to talk to each other online, it just felt like it was going to be very isolating. So Hermannaut was a way to kind of build a hearth that people could gather around and talk about these things. And just to the limited extent that was possible back in the days before the internet, it worked, and it was really fun and rewarding for that reason. And another thing, you bring up the quality of writing in academia, and basically our only rule for writing for Hermannaut was there's no footnotes. Because what we noticed from academia in those days, back when we were in school, was that people would write these dry, boring, you know, super objective, supposedly objective essays, and then put all the jokes and the funny stuff and the interesting stuff and the humor and the real insights and the flashes of genius and their insights into their own obsessions and beliefs and so forth would always be relegated to the footnotes. And it became a whole, in the 90s, it was like a whole shtick almost, that you had these boring titles, you know, short titles with a long, more interesting, sexy subtitle.
Well, that's hilarious, because that's even physically separating the highbrow from the lowbrow, right?
Right.
Because the footnote is the low and the text is above it.
Yeah, right, exactly. So we would get essays sent to us that were separating them in that way, and we would say, look, we'd like to publish these ideas, but you got to reintegrate. You got to put it back together. And I do think that Shakespeare was someone in whom these things were integrated. There's no footnotes, and of course we do footnote him now, but you know, he didn't write with footnotes. And I think that it's almost like, is it in Kabbalah where there's the idea that God used to be contained in these vessels that were shattered at some point, and and what you have to do on Earth is kind of create sparks that will rebuild the vessel. And I think that, you know, the battle of the brows is a diversion from what we should be doing, which is bringing it all back together. And I think
that's
the middle brow, unfortunately, has sold itself very effectively as a way of bridging high brow and low brow. And I actually believe that middle brow drives them apart. It doesn't bring them together.
Yeah, that was the main message I took away from my college sort of learning of the zone, was just to always be very, the way that I think about it is that I have to always be very aware when I'm in a middle brow space, because sometimes, like, a classic thing will happen to me is I'll start reading, like, kind of op-ed language, you know, whatever, like in the Times, or, you know, something in that zone where someone's pontificating about the politics or cultural politics or something like that. And, you know, then I'm kind of reading along, and then I'm like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. That's a clear way of thinking about it. And then I start finding myself kind of assenting and kind of going, yeah. And then I realize, if I step back, that there's this kind of congealed, sort of easy kind of position that I've now, like, woven myself into, that's very kind of neat and just sort of, you know, it kind of keeps the contradictions at bay. And then I'm like, oh man, I just got sucked into middle brow. It's like, you gotta watch yourself too, because it's sort of the lingua franca in terms of, like, thinking about politics and whatever with a larger society, more so than these other kind of more peripheral zones. I mean, there's tons of politics everywhere. But, you know, it's an interesting thing to happen. But I'm curious, when switching to, you know, the online medium, how, you know, that must have been like a point to kind of reassess the way that, you know, publishing and cultural mechanisms themselves create and break down these distinctions. I mean, one of the things that I think characterized, you know, sort of started in the 80s with cultural studies, but really came, you know, to fruit in the 90s, and you were part of that, was a recognition that you can play a lot with these levels, and that, in fact, by mixing them, you can make a lot of effects. Some are profound, some are actually kind of cheesy in their own way, but it was a time of kind of mixture and not necessarily reintegration, but of sampling across levels. And Zine World was a kind of place to play with that. And then, you know, like everything else, the internet changes, like, all of these modalities and modes of organizing things so much. So when you came to, like, starting a webzine, you know, you got a lot of ambitions about it. You clearly put a tremendous amount of work into it. How did you think differently about the sort of goal that you had started out with Hermannaut in your earlier stuff?
I never wanted to publish a blog. I mean, I've been very interested in the internet and the web from early on, but because, you know, I saw them in two reasons. One, I saw that as a way to build community, you know, with people who were interested in the same things you were, who didn't necessarily live where you lived. Which I just think is the most amazing thing about this medium. And the other thing about it was, I forget what the other thing was about it, that it was cheap. You know, you could do things on there that you couldn't afford to do offline. And you could, the second thing really was that you could support offline endeavors through this online endeavor. So you could, you know, for example, N+1, which is a journal I write for sometimes, they're able to publish a blog that publishes pieces in between their their issues, and they're able to have online subscription sales and get the word out that way. And these are all advantages that I didn't have publishing Hermonaut. So for me, the internet is really just it's a medium that I'm interested in. I can't say that I've explored its modalities in any philosophically rigorous way through Heilerbrau, but as a medium for creating a life of the mind outside of the academy, I think it's an incredible gift.
So what are some of the things you've learned about the best way to do that? I mean, you've been trying different things. You know, of course, there's partly just a financial question, like how do you create a sustainable situation in terms of having some kind of, you know, income flowing into it. But even more, like what are some ways to keep it sustained in terms of, like, you know, the amount of material? You know, I've had friends who've done, you know, online blogs, and they're just like, oh my God, you just, like, it's like this horrible hamster wheel where you just have to, like, constantly be putting, because the way that they saw it, they had to constantly be putting material on there. The material itself got shorter and shorter and more bit-like and more farther and farther away from the long-form zones where some of the things, you know, that are more like some of the engaged essays that you were really interested in back in the day. And that itself is a really tricky balance. Like, how do you balance people's need for sort of a feed with the kind of demands of a longer form and therefore producing much more content?
Yeah, well, a few points there. One is that you've heard me say community a few times already in this interview, and for me, that's what it's about. I don't like to think on my own. I don't like to do anything on my own. I don't like to eat dinner on my own. I like to do things as part of the community. One thing I loved about publishing zines as opposed to working at magazines and newspapers, which I've also done, is that although you're supposedly writing for this much huger audience when you're writing for a national magazine or a newspaper, it always felt like shouting from the top of a mountaintop, and you just didn't know if anybody was listening or was anyone reading you. Whereas you publish a zine, you send it to 40 people, and you got 40 letters back or 40 other zines back. So it always felt like you're working in this community space. And so that's been very important to me with Heilerbrau. So Heilerbrau really isn't just my website. I'm the editor of it, but, you know, there's 20 or 30 writers at any one time who are working for it. So I'm always trying to, you know, sort of part of what I do with my week every week is, as I'm reading other blogs and other things and seeing people that seem interesting to me and I like what they're doing, I try to rope them into my world and get them to write for Heilerbrau for $10 a pop or whatever. So that's an important way to be able to keep it going without burning out, is that I don't do it on my own.
Well, and that's a really big distinction, I think, too, in the way that a lot of other of these, like, highbrow internet publications are doing it, where they're even, like, putting it into the hands of robots, sort of, where they're grabbing stuff randomly off the internet about a certain subject and piecemealing it together, where that aspect of a unified consciousness behind a website is deteriorating in so many of those highbrow places, to the extent that it's now all artificial intelligence, whereas the high-lowbrow one is organized on such a different level with trying to reintegrate consciousness instead of, like, break it apart and make it all these little bitey things like Eric was talking about.
Yeah, and you're reminding me that back when I used to work at Utney Reader magazine back in the 90s, and I was publishing a zine at the same time, and I would go to zine conferences where people would be very upset with me for publishing something that had a color cover, and this is my zine of Hermonaut.
Yeah.
It had a color cover and a perfect bounce bind, and it was spell-checked and so forth, and it didn't seem like a zine to a lot of people. They had this very authentic, you know, this sort of sense of authenticity about zines. They had to be homemade. You had to steal the printing from your parents' work. You know, you had to handwrite stuff, and things had to be misspelled and had to be black and white, et cetera, et cetera. And my take was always, you know, my zine is not being published by some rich person with a trust fund. I'm working and struggling to get this thing out, but I want it to look nice. And to me, the difference between a zine and a magazine is that a magazine is always something that's published in order to please a certain, you know, targeted readership and, you know, that you can sell ads to. And a zine, no matter what it looks like, what its circulation is something that's published completely because that's what the editors want it to be like.
Mm.
But to me, Harper's is basically a zine. You know, Harper's at its best is a zine. Or, you know, the Beastie Boys magazine Grand Royal was a zine. They didn't look anything like zines. But, you know, you can tell when you pick those up that every single word in there is there because the editor wanted it to be, because that's what the editors, that's what they're into, and that's what they like. So to me, that's what sets Heilerbrau apart from other content aggregating websites, I guess.
Well, I wanted also to switch to talking about the book line that you're just starting. I think this month, High Low Books. You know, talking about the publishing line is one thing, but it's really clearly motivated by your own obsession with a particular period of science fiction that's relatively obscure, the Radium Age. And so, you know, before we talk about the books and how that's integrated in the site, because I think you're doing really interesting things with, you know, what is a book now? Why do you bring a physical book out? How do you integrate it into online environments, et cetera, et cetera? But before that, it's like, what is the Radium Age of science fiction?
Right. So, you know, I grew up reading science fiction, you know, my favorite thing to read as a teenager and beyond. But, of course, like most people, what I was reading was what's called the golden age of science fiction, so stuff published between the late 1930s and the late 60s. And, of course, I was also interested in stuff that came after that, New Wave, Philip K. Dick type of stuff. But, you know, a lot of what I was reading was Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, these kind of giants of the golden age. And, you know, over the years, as I've kind of delved deeper and deeper into to science fiction, trying to find things that I hadn't heard of before, I discovered that there's all these things that were published in the 1900s, 10s, and 20s that nobody talks about, and they're not written about, and you look at any timeline of science fiction, they're not on those timelines, except for maybe Aldous Huxley. Sometimes Yevgeny Zamyatin, who wrote the dystopian novel We, that was only published in Samizdat in Russia, or Charlotte Perkins Gilman, but really, and of course Edgar Rice Burroughs, a couple of the big ones, but you know, there's a lot of stuff that authors you've never heard of or books by authors that you have heard of, like Rudyard Kipling and Jack London and Arthur Conan Doyle, that appeared in this kind of 30-year time period, and I'm calling it 1904 to 33, that weren't written about, and I was curious why. And if you read, you know, Brian Aldiss's excellent history of science fiction, he's quite dismissive of this era, which he just sort of calls it naive and not very well written. Is how he sums it up. And Isaac Asimov in the 70s did a whole series called the Before the Golden Age, where he published a bunch of stories that he grew up reading in the 30s. But in his introduction, he's very apologetic and saying, you know, if you've read the stuff from the Golden Age, from the John Campbell years, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you're going to think this stuff is naive and silly and badly written. But I went and read it, and it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't that bad. It was pretty good. It's very interesting. I mean, it might be people certainly learned how to do science fiction in a very smooth, confident, compelling way after the late 1930s. But I'm actually a little bit suspicious of that, because to me, anything that's smooth and the edges are rubbed off starts to head towards middlebrow. So I'm actually quite interested in this kind of rougher science fiction that came after the kind of great era of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, which to me ends around the time that Wells stopped writing good novels, which is around 1904. And which, so this Radium Age stuff that I'm talking about picks up around there and runs through the early 30s, at which point John W. Campbell becomes editor of, Astounding Stories? And
yeah.
You know, starts to kind of put a stamp of quality on everything. Which, you know, again, I like that stuff. I've read it. It's important science fiction. But to me, it's not as interesting. I'm very excited about this period, but I feel like I'm an explorer who's discovered it, and there's very little of it available. You have to order it online and get it. Some of it's just not even available online. It's in the British Library or wherever.
It's so interesting, too, because a lot of those kind of Radium era books, like the We book by Yevgeny Zamyatin, that one is amazing, and that really set the tone for all of those, like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, mm-hmm. 1984, like all of those more polished versions of that book actually aren't addressing some of the more emotional, you know, humanistic, moralistic things. They address it more later in the Golden Age. They take it to this kind of cultural thing, where I feel like a lot of the Radium ones are way more, like, intensely personal about an individual, almost more like maybe some of Philip K. Dick's stuff, where it gets into the emotions of the individual instead of just examining this philosophy on a societal level that's told through this science fiction story, you know?
Yeah, they don't tend not to be sort of philosophical novels in that sense of the kind of Ayn Rand or George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, where they're really basically selling you a political line gussied up inside of a story.
Right.
Yeah, there's something much weirder happening in them.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about science fiction. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Masha Dawu. We're talking to Joshua Glenn, editor of HighLowBrow.com and High Low Books, and we'll be back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Masha Dawu. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking to Joshua Glenn about all things high and low, as they tend to go. And it's such an interesting progression that you kind of started out with zines and then go to internet and then kind of revert back to publishing these forgotten books. It's a pretty good timeline, I think. Can you talk a little bit about how these books are being received? Like, in this kind of time, a lot of book accoutrements are disappearing amongst the internet. So it's fascinating for someone that's so involved in an internet zine to actually go to publishing these old sci-fi novels. I mean, are they getting a good reception from people?
Well, the first one has just come out this month, so it's too early to say if they're getting a good reception, but they're getting a good reception online, and I'll explain what I mean. We were inspired by our friend Richard Nash, who's a really visionary book futurist publisher. He used to do Soft Skull Press, and he started something called Cursor a while ago. And the idea of Cursor, now he's a small demons. But the idea of Cursor was that, you could use this exactly this power of the internet that we were just talking about earlier, this idea that you can aggregate people interested in the same things together in a way that's so powerful, in a way that you never could before this medium came along. So if you could get people together talking about a book before it was even written, while it was being written, perhaps participating somehow in the writing, like talking to the author, reading his draft, giving notes, whatever it was, that you could actually build an audience for a book before it even comes out. So it would be an interesting way to, especially for small independent publishers and people working outside of the middlebrow literary model, to kind of ensure that they had an audience for their book before it came out, instead of kind of casting it onto the waters and abandoning it. Actually having people who already knew about the book and were invested in it emotionally before it even exists. So I approached Richard and said I wanted to do this with these science fiction novels. I didn't want to write them in this public space, and because I'm actually taking them out of the public domain. Somebody else has already written these. But I wanted to build an audience online for them and add value to these public domain things by proofing them rigorously against the first editions, which a lot of online public domain texts are not, and B, getting new people to write new critical introductions to them, including Eric. I want to do one. And then also, designing these beautiful paperback, with my friend Tony and Michael doing these beautiful covers and book design. So adding a lot of value to these things and then serializing them online with, in kind of an old fashioned 19th century model of, putting up a chunk of them every week, for our high-lowbrow readers to enjoy, and then assembling them all into this book, beautiful book package, and putting them out at the end of the process, and hopefully, we will have already built an audience for the book and sell some copies. So it's kind of reverse engineering the process in a way.
Well, I just love that invocation of the old idea of a serial, because in a way it's the 19th century form of precisely that kind of that need for a feed that so much defines online, information flow, where like people like want to know when they go back that there's going to be a little bit more. I think even also the popularity of HBO and the sort of return of television shows is also kind of about, there's something about the way that little bits of a narrative, a serialization stabilize us as we sort of navigate through information space. And I know that you've also serialized not just these older novels, but James Parker's work on High Lowbrow, and that was that worked out really well, right? People really responded to that.
Yeah, well, my partner in High Low Books, Matthew Battles, is also a book futurist, and he's very interested in the history of serialized novels. And together, we came up with this idea to force our friend James, a very talented writer who never actually writes fiction. He writes for the Atlantic Monthly, but we know that he was capable of writing fiction. to, we figured maybe a serialized novel would be the answer, because then he wouldn't have to write it all at once. He would have a built-in audience, so he would sort of feel kind of compelled to get something out. There would be a deadline built in, and we would try to pay him a little money each time. So basically it's taking somebody who's used to writing as this kind of monthly columnist and giving him all those things that impel him to do that monthly column and get him to do it for a piece of fiction. And so what we did was raise money on Kickstarter. And we had enough money to be able to pay James and Kristen Parker to illustrate it. And, yeah, serialize it online, and it was a big hit. And then we published it. We self-published it on one of those machines at Harvard Bookstore here where you can just press a button and a beautiful book comes out the other end.
I mean, that's so pulp style, because back in the day they would, like, all these authors would publish their short stories and, you know, Weird Tales or whatever, Astonishing Tales, and then they would compile them and then they'd have, like, these novels. I mean, that's like most of the Conan stuff was done that way, and tons of science fiction stuff was really made that way. So it's such a kind of throwback to that. It's very kind of zany style.
Right. Well, and you think of how albums used to be collections of 45s.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
And or even a lot of the great intellectuals of the mid-century, they didn't, you know, like someone like Irving Howe, he didn't write books. He wrote essays, and that were collected into books with great titles. I think that kind of what do they call it, granularity, whatever, some hip word they would use for something like that now. But breaking things back down into their component parts instead of trying to gin them up into something that they probably aren't is a good idea.
Well, I want to go back to another thing about the radio mage thing, because we talked a little bit about just, you know, sort of some of the more practical reasons for turning to it and just your fascination with it, you know, as a genre. But I think there's something a little bit more there for me. And the more that I read in the sort of history of popular genres, particularly fantasy and science fiction, which are the ones that I'm most into, and the gothic to some degree, that there's something really interesting that happens at the end of the 19th century and the very beginning of the 20th century, that in some ways there's sort of the groundwork is being laid for the whole construction of the popular imagination through popular media, you know, and so that even if, like you say, the later science fiction, golden age science fiction, is often kind of smooth in a certain way, it's confident, it's the realms of its genre, and that it's only later that you find people starting to pull that apart or critique it with the new wave, and later with cyberpunk, which has its own kind of smoothness. That in this earlier phase, you can kind of feel things getting sort of putting in place, but it's not just like a genre, like science fiction. It's just the whole way that we imagine ourselves and the future and the past through popular media. And I know that, like, the more, you know, when I have much more limited time for reading fiction, I find myself drawn to that period over and over again in different genres, probably because there's a certain kind of approach to narrative in the British in particular that I really appreciate. But there's some weird way in which it kind of, like, resonates with maybe a moment that's more where we are now, where there's so much change, there's so many, you know, genres breaking down, forms, the actual media themselves, there's the sense of mutant possibility, but it's not really clear what it's going to look like, and then there's all this trash that we're overwhelmed with, and it's a very weird kind of time. And there's something about that period where, in some ways, like the first great, almost real fictions are developed, like the Sherlock Holmes, like the character who you believe is actually a real guy. I mean, we had Michael Soller on the show, you know, a couple of months ago, talking about this book he did, As If, which was about the emergence of this new mode of fiction where there's something slightly real about it, metafictional about it, and this, a lot of the work that you're looking at there, it has some of that characteristic. So I'm just kind of curious, what is it about that period, do you think? Because I know it's not just a period in the history of a genre, it's also, you know, the end of the Gilded Age through, you know, the early Depression. Like, there's something that's going on in that whole historical time that gets reflected in these books.
Right. Well, so, like you say, it was definitely, there was no such thing as science fiction until Hugo Gernsback started calling that in the 20s. So a lot of these people writing these books that I'm interested in didn't know they were writing science fiction. So what were they doing? What did they think they were doing? And it was it's an amazing period. It's probably the single most, vertiginous period of technological change that human society has ever experienced, and, you know, before or after. It's never changed quite that much in people's lifetimes. So all that was going on, and, the political order, the old ancien regime of kings and princes and queens and, you know, monarchies were kind of going away in as democracy was emerging, and things were really changing, and there was a sense that as the anti-globalization people like to say it, the sense that another world was possible. And I think that it was both terrifying and really hopeful and liberating, and people were exploring what that might mean. And I think that a big difference between people writing science fiction in the 1910s and 20s and people writing it in the 40s and 50s is that Hitler and Stalin hadn't happened yet. So, and I think that when those guys happened, when all that happened, that really put a big, big, huge kibosh on utopian thinking and the idea that we really could reorganize society and we really could work towards radical social justice and all these things that people kind of believed that really were around the corner in the 1910s and 20s. Because they had seen so much change already, people weren't allowed to talk about that anymore. You had to be very cynical about that stuff after the 30s.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, I mean, at that time in the 10s and 20s, that was literally when radium and radioactivity were being discovered by, like, Marie Curie, and, you know, Rutherford was getting into all that stuff, too. And so that was before people were seeing that there was radioactivity and there was this kind of etheric crazy thing we don't quite understand about atoms, it's magic, and it was before we made it into bombs. So it's like when we just discover this crazy phenomenon, all of the aggregate of those novels start forming with that utopian idea, and then after we kind of like mess it up gigantically, then it all kind of crumbles into these more, you know, like you said, dystopian things.
Yes, very, really well put, and I'm glad you brought up radium, because it was just, radium is the perfect, that's why I chose the word radium, besides the fact that I like the phrase radium age, seemed like the perfect metaphor for this era, because yes, as you say, radium was this incredible sense of, gave us a sense of radical possibility that matter itself is in motion.
Yeah.
We didn't know that before. And so that gave people that idea that, well, geez, I mean, perhaps unlimited energy is possible, perhaps matter, you know, transmutation is possible. Perhaps, you know, all kinds of things could be done thanks to radium. As we know, it mostly turned into weapons and kind of health cures that actually gave you cancer. But at that moment, from 1904 to 33, 1934, I think, is when Marie Curie died of radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
But before, up until then, it sort of is this metaphor for this incredible sense of possibility that people had. And, you know, and like I said, they weren't just naively optimistic and thinking everything would be okay. People were quite worried about things changing that radically. But either way, it was a utopian, you know, it was a utopian sense that another world is possible, that the kind of spell of the quotidian, the spell of the everyday, of everything always being the same, was broken for that for a couple of decades there.
So what's a good example from one of those, because we haven't really talked about the specific novels that you're bringing out. I think you're starting out with the Jack London novel, but what's a good example of one of the from one of the things you're going to be putting out of one of these utopian ideas that you find inspiring or really interesting or kind of novel, you know, looking at it, you know, from this very different point where there's so much cynicism and such a history of cynicism. What's a kind of interesting and inspiring bit from one of the novels?
I'm writing an introduction right now to Arthur Conan Doyle's novel The Poison Belt, which is the second installment in his Professor Challenger series that people don't really know about anymore. But Professor Challenger was his other great literary creation. I mean, I'm actually also a big fan of his Brigadier Gerard. I shouldn't say his only other great creation, but Professor Challenger was his other great investigator besides Sherlock Holmes. Professor Challenger is a scientist who's has an incredible mind and an incredible logic of the process of reasoning. So like Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock Holmes is constantly comparing the way he reasons to the way the police detectives reason. And they are very, they're these kind of scientific materialists. They have these hypotheses and they are following, they're running experiments and looking for clues and trying to prove or disprove a hypothesis. And Sherlock Holmes never works that way. He leaps backwards and looks for like a kind of a law-like rule about how people behave. And it's often kind of, it's funny reading them now because it often seems very bigoted and biased about how, you know, a woman in love always walks up and down the sidewalk nervously or whatever it is. but he has these kind of these law-like rules in his head that he has gathered from, you know, all the observation and study, research and study that he does. And then he leaps forward to try to explain this fact that can't be explained by that law. He has to explain away the facts, and that's how his reasoning works. And that is actually a kind of a utopian mode of reasoning, this idea that the thing about scientific materialism and this kind of very cautious empirical studies that Doyle's kind of writing against in the Challenger novels and the Doyle novels is that it can never introduce anything new. It can never come up with a new idea about how the world works and how the universe works and how people work. It always is just kind of setting up these very cautious experiments and trying to prove these very small rules. And Doyle's interested in something much larger, you know, bringing intuition and imagination back into logical reasoning, combining them.
So I'm so glad you're writing about that. Are you going to talk about Peirce's idea of abduction at all?
Abduction is the main thing that I'm talking about in the essay.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're doing that because it's sort of complicated idea in some ways. You might have a better way of going into it than I would right now. But I know that like encountering that idea was like, oh my God, there's a way, there's another way. It's not just okay, we're scientific materialists. We put together little pieces. We make tentative hypotheses. We prove them with experiments over time, and then nobody can really, you know, attack the theory too much.
Right. It's all about building a citadel of truth, and then you have to defend that citadel.
You know,
a narrow-minded way to be.
That
mode of reasoning has brought us a long way. It has given us a lot. But it's not the only mode of reasoning, and it's purposely and virtuously unimaginative. It tries to drive imagination out of reasoning and thinking.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful example. I just actually read the Poison Belt a week or so ago, and I loved it. It was a great book on many levels. You know, narratively, it's a great tale. It's science is funny, the characters are great, and I really look forward to reading your introduction on that one. But what's the one that's coming out this month?
So Jack London's The Scarlet Plague comes out this month, and that's Jack London looking at, you know, he's sort of one of the early explorers of the idea that in some ways it might be better if society devolved due to some great catastrophe. It's a sort of conservative, almost fascist vision of how things, you know, society is very corrupt and decadent, and people have become weak and bad because of civilization. So, you know, it's chimes with some sort of proto-fascist thinking around that same time. And, you know, although we would lose a lot if we devolved back to a kind of more savage state, we would also gain certain things. So I'm not saying that I can get behind the philosophy of all the books that I'm publishing, but they're very interesting moments in the history of ideas around these things.
Well, and it's interesting, too, in terms of high-lowbrow, because there is this phenomenon that kind of happens in sci-fi books and utopian things, and it kind of goes one of either two ways. It goes to lowbrow or it goes to highbrow, because people talk about society developing into these, like, highly super technologically advanced, like, very computer, robo kind of things, or everything goes Lord of the Flies style, right? And
yeah.
A lot of the philosophies kind of look at humanity in terms of those two extremes. It goes either high or low. Like, we either develop into these, like, nanobot-driven, you know, plasma amalgams, or we all go super primal style and then just, like, you know, start going after Piggy. So, to me, philosophically, those two extremes of the thought pattern of novels is very high-lowbrow.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And the next book we're publishing is also kind of an ambiguous utopia also. It's Rudyard Kipling's With the Night Mail and a follow-up story they did, As Easy as ABC, which came out in 1912. So these are centennial editions. Scarlet Plague and As Easy as ABC came out 100 years ago this year.
Wow.
And Kipling's novel is all about a future in which airships, as opposed to airplanes, have taken over, and they're incredibly efficient, and people can travel all over the world in them. And the Aerial Board of Control, the ABC, this international corporate entity that keeps the trains moving on time, essentially, is so good at what they do that all the qualling nations of the earth have decided that they, in the interest of peace and prosperity, they're going to give over their own governance to the ABC. So this airship company ends up running the whole world kind of reluctantly. And there's basically these very kind of high-minded, Kipling-esque technocrats, the white man's burden kind of a thing, who just they do it because they have to. They civilization has to be brought to these people in Chicago somehow, so I guess we're the ones who have to do it. So it's a fascinating, it's supposed to be utopian, but even Kipling can't quite bring himself to countenance everything that he can imagine coming as a result of that happening.
Well, so
they're very interesting, moments. And, you know, these are memes, essentially, that take off in the Golden Age. You know, the dystopian utopia,
yeah.
That's all about efficiency. Or there's a lot of telepathy is a big thing that comes up in radio image science fiction, and robots that go berserk, you know, and the Superman who might or might not be here to help us. These memes, I feel, spring out of this period of radical possibility. Also, there's kind of a lot of Darwinian, Lamarckian, Bergsonian philosophical arguments about evolution that I won't get into here, but that also play into some of the ideas about kind of the future of the human race in some of these books. So it's
but again,
things weren't really, people didn't feel like they knew what the future held. I think now we sort of feel like we know, and we're quite cynical and worried about things going the direction of Hitler or Stalin. So everything it happens in a much more constrained way, even in science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's that idea that somehow, because they're really wrestling with the bedrock issues that we're still, Darwinian evolution, what's the future of human being, networked consciousness, robots, android, all of those things, the sort of sense that we're on the verge of certain kinds of capacities that have a quality of telepathy, even if they're not actual psychic powers, all of those things that you're talking about, we're still swimming in it, and yet somehow by looking a little bit farther back, and particularly at the people that in some ways were the first generation or, a half step later, who are just wrestling with these ideas for the first time. I mean, we're really thinking about, like, oh, my God, we could have machines that, like, are like, creatures. Oh, my God. Or
yeah.
or evolution. You know, Darwin's, it's incredible. We swim in this stuff so much that, to reach for a contemporary science fiction as a way to get a handle on our moment, yeah, sometimes that could be really remarkable because we see the intensification of certain elements that are already going on around us, and it's like, yeah, okay, I can get a handle on that. But to get a bigger picture, to get that context, that larger context in a sense for how our moment, in both its reality and its science fictional qualities, including our fantasies about what reality is, which are, of course, deeply science fictional, that going a little bit farther back, reaching not back to the fathers, but the grandfathers or the great grandfathers and mothers, that you actually get a better handle on things, or at least a sense of a wider context within which the things we face happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's, if I had stayed in academia, I think history of ideas would have been my field, and I'm very influenced by people like Christopher Lash, for example, who, writing in the late 60s, instead of writing about what was happening then, was writing about, earlier generations of kind of radical reformers who rejected liberalism but were leftists, and what were they all about, and how did that help us understand 1960s radicalism? And in a similar way, I find, that I have a much stronger grip on not only what's happening today in science fiction, but in the golden age of science fiction, thanks to reading this stuff that those golden age guys grew up reading and supposedly rejected because it was so naively utopian.
Right.
But it obviously had a deep impact on them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we only have like a minute left, but just saying this is a long question, but just where do you feel like the play, do we have a strong call for a utopian imagination now? How do we recover that?
Yeah, I think that we don't. People don't believe that another world is possible anymore. And so, yeah, in my very small way, with my small websites and publications and so forth, I would like to remind people that we at least used to believe that.
Well, wonderful, man. Thanks so much for being on the show, Joshua. This is a fascinating conversation. I just want to mention again, highlowbrow.com and High Low Books. So thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much. Bye, guys.
All right, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.